in addition to, again, the ones that are... Oh, did we make the copies?
Yeah, I left it here.
Oh, jeez. Okay.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
I must have forgotten to do that. I'll bring them next time. Let's see what is here. Oh, yeah.
It's there.
That's the list that's in the web book. So in addition to that list, did everyone get a copy? Yeah. Okay, so and then I keep adding additional ones as I present in the class. Okay. Today I think we are talking about the South Indian Bhakti tradition, mainly focusing on the Tamil Alvars. There are two, the Alvars and the Nayanmars, but today we'll talk more about the Tamil Alvars. Alvar literally means the one who has drowned in Tamil. That is why I think A.K. Ramanujan translated some of those hymns as hymns for the drowning. It's a kind of an allegorical, symbolic kind of meaning that they have become so engrossed in the devotion of the divine, and then forgot the rest of the society, the norms and so on. So the beginnings of this, the rise of this Bhakti movement in the south is traced historically to around 7th century. But hagiographical literature, I don't know if you know the word hagiography. Historiography is history that we know, the empirical history. Hagiography is hagios, means saints in Greek. It's the quote-unquote history, if you call it history, of these saints. And there, because the material is drawn from not necessarily historically provable kind of data, it's like legends and anecdotes and all kinds of things are woven, myths and so on. The idea basically is to emphasize the enormous spiritual and religious importance of those people for that tradition. So therefore no one questions the historicity of those statements and so on, if you are a member of the tradition. So for them it is, so you can see the dating, the conventional dating can go all the way back to before the Common Era, 4200 to 2700 BCE. Even in the modern scholarship, some have dated as far back as 5th century Common Era, but it's kind of a risky kind of enterprise. It's hard to prove exactly whether those dates are accurate. But there might have been some kind of initial rumblings, as it were, you know, kind of, there may have been isolated poets who may not have been recognized by then or even later made it into the canon or the canonical literature, but there might have been some of those people that may have contributed something towards that Bhakti movement. Tradition also regards these Alvars as of divine origin. Now what this means is, here it's an interesting concept. Normally you have a notion of incarnation in the traditional classical Hindu understanding, that is, God takes a human form or another form, not necessarily human, but any other form. In other words, God incarnating in the form of a living being, creature, whether human or non-human. Like in the case of Vishnu, he has all kinds of animal forms as well, lion, boar, and so on. Now here, that concept is kind of reworked in a way to bring in an interesting kind of twist. There are two ideas that are mentioned here. One is the idea of possession. Of course, you have the idea of possession in virtually all religious traditions in various ways, including the tribal religions where you talk about possessing of a person, you know, the ancestor spirits coming, possessing that individual and so on. And in Christianity, you have the spirit of God descending and the whole Pentecostal experience and all that, you know, the early disciples of Christ being, being kind of empowered by the Spirit, as it were. So there the usage is possessed by the Spirit and so on. So you have that idea. So that idea is brought in here in a sense that Vishnu, in this case, possesses these individuals, as it were, or these individuals are possessed by Vishnu, and then they, in a way, are treated not only as the devotees of Vishnu, but also at times Vishnu himself, because they are actually possessed by Vishnu, and therefore Vishnu is in them. And here, of course, the old Vedanta notion of, philosophical notion of God as the indweller, you know, God who dwells within humans and within his creation and so on, and at the same time, God who is above all of them. So here there is this play of that concept also comes in. But of course, these are not sophisticated philosophers, but somehow in their own way, they seem to kind of articulate a notion similar or analogous to that. And then the other idea associated with this is the idea that not only Vishnu who possesses these people and hence incarnates himself in the form of, in other words, the distinction here is, in just staying with that idea of possessing and the incarnation, is in the case of the classical idea of incarnation, Vishnu takes the birth of a human or any other being. So it's the person is Rama or Krishna, whoever it is in this case, is born, and Vishnu is born in the form of Krishna or Rama, etc. Now here, possession by Vishnu means that there is the person already born, and then Vishnu at some point in his life possesses him, takes hold of him. And it could be not a continuous thing. It could be during that particular time of ritual or singing, etc., you could consider that person having been possessed by Vishnu or somebody and then leaving. So it's somewhat similar to what we see in the village Hinduism today, even today, more so in the earlier 19th century and up to the early 20th century, but that tradition is kind of village goddess, you know, tradition, where the goddess takes possession of an individual in the village, and then the village kind of behaves as the divine and the goddess and so on. And you know, there is all kinds of things are attached to those things, you know, miracles and so on, healing, etc. And then the second idea related to that is some of the, especially these 12 Alvars, the Alvars are numbered as 12. The full list is, it's in this book. There is another book that lists all the 12. These have only selection of the 12, but these 12 of them are considered the most important saints in the Tamil Bhakti tradition, Vaishnava Bhakti tradition. And these people are seen not only as the incarnation in that possession sense of Vishnu, but also, or perhaps separately or additionally, as particular symbols or emblems associated with Vishnu. Now, we know Vishnu is associated with the wheel, the conch, you know, these symbols, the bow, the arrow, and all these, you know, Rama's symbols and so on. So these people are associated with those symbols. In other words, it's like that the wheel of Vishnu is born as a particular alvar. So in other words, this alvar is the wheel of that this thing. Now this idea is actually not foreign to classical Hinduism. I mean, you would find in the epic story, in the case of the Rama's brothers, Vishnu is Rama, and Balarama, etc., all these people are Vishnu's various emblems. So the idea is not foreign to classical Hindu thinking. So this is why I think, who was it? George Hart, Ramanujan refers to his ideas in a separate article that he wrote, talks about these devotional poets, although they were using vernacular, Tamil in this case, as their medium, but that whole movement of that period was already circumscribed by Sanskritic, Brahmanical writings and their thinking. So in other words, they are actually, although they are not necessarily educated intellectual people, but they are in some way aware of these key concepts and ideas because they are kind of in vogue, as it were. These alvars are also associated with their supernatural births, and this is quite a frequently known aspect, mostly even these days, you know, the so-called gurus and you know, the swamijis and so on, even while they are still alive, like Satya Sai Baba, for instance, their birth is gradually retrospectively written, the story of their birth, that would give a kind of a special significance to that birth. In other words, although he may have been born as like any other ordinary human being, but then the story, as they write later on, gives that twist that he was actually born in a special way, and the family treated him in a special way, and then the village came to know about his, you know, special birth, and all kinds of details are added. Whether or not those details were actually historically accurate, you know, of course, for the devotee, it doesn't concern, because that's not the, you know, important thing for them. The important thing is the spiritual significance of the master the Guru, Swami, and so on. Now, my note here is what I'm saying here is that these ideas of incarnation and supernatural births are taken not so much from the Purana texts, the Hindu mythological texts, but from a special genre of texts known as agamas. In this case, Pancharatra agamas. There are two types of agama texts. The Vaikhanasa agamas, Pancharatra, both are associated with the Vaishnava worship. Here a new idea of incarnation is introduced. Vishnu is said to be entering into the human beings who are already born, and this idea you would see in the agama texts. In the sense of God infusing special power into selected individuals. As I said, the number of these avas is 12. The most important one considered, especially for the later systematic theology of the what became known as Visishtadvaita or qualified non-dual philosophy of Ramanuja, associated with Ramanuja, was the poetic works of Namalwar. He was probably one the most powerful poet of the 12 and most extensively used by the later commentators when they commented upon the Vedanta texts and so on. And there is another female Alvar as well, Andal, one of which I will read some of these selections from these people, so you will see, you will have a taste of what they are like. Andal especially became significant in more recent sort of studies because of the special sort of significance attached to women's studies, gender studies, and feminist ideas, and so on. Here is Andal as far back as 9th century, perhaps, talks about quite radical ideas, calling into question the existing conventions of that time. So the contemporary scholars have made use of those writings of Andal and so on. In my book on the goddess Sri Lakshmi, in my concluding chapter towards the end, I extensively discussed as to how the development of this whole tradition actually evolved. So if you want to take a look at it, you can read it in my book that's listed up there, the third, right after Clooney. There I identified five important phases through which the this whole theology develops, theology of this particular tradition. The first formative phase is what is associated as the period of the Alvars. So what happens during this period is these 12 Alvars lived anywhere between 700 Common Era to about the end of 900 Common Era. So about 200 years or so is the period during which these 12 Alvars are said to have lived and, you know, composed their poems and so on. And what they did was they went around from temple to temple and sang the hymns in praise of Vishnu, and therefore they are associated A with the local temple and B with the local names of Vishnu. So for them, Vishnu is not like Vishnu in general, you know, in the Puranas and so on, but the local, like say in Sri Rangam, Ranganatha, or Varadaraja, the local name of the god Vishnu is more important for them than the generic name. So for about 200 or so years, they have spontaneously went around singing these things, I mean songs, and there is no evidence of them having actually committed them to the written form. They may have been in vogue in oral tradition or in the community, you know, during their lifetime and after their lifetime. And what happens around the 9th century, Brahmanical intellectual called Nadamani goes wrong. I think by this time, the Sanskritic Brahmanical tradition is fairly well established through Jainism and Buddhism and the Brahmanical Hinduism. And then they began to tap into the local vernacular ideas. So what Nadamani from the north, he comes to south and settles there, and then he goes around, he was quite fascinated by the powerful ideas that are coming through these local songs. So he goes around collecting all of these songs, and for the first time he puts together, like an editor, modern editor, and compiles them into what became known as Nal Aira Divya Prabhandam. That means 4,000 great book. The great book of 4,000 verses. So there were altogether about 4,000 verses that he collected. There might have been more, who knows. And that's the second period, what I call contextualization of the tradition. In other words, what he does then is he locates those 4,000 hymns within the broader Brahmanical tradition of Vaishnavism. And then, during the time of his successors, namely Yamuna and Ramanuja thereafter, especially both of them, have systematically articulated these ideas, although neither of them wrote any commentaries on these hymns, but they drew ideas from these works in a kind of free fashion, and in their commentaries of the Sanskrit texts, namely Vedanta Sutras and the Bhagavad Gita and the various Upanishadic texts that they commented upon, they made extensive use of these ideas. Of course, they never, in the case of Yamuna and Ramanuja, never openly kind of committed themselves to either acknowledging those sources or openly writing commentaries on these texts. But the hagiographies mention their loyalties to the Alvar tradition, Alvar Bhakti tradition. So in other words, there is a memory in the community that lives on, remembering how deeply Yamuna and Ramanuja appreciated the ideas of Alvars. But they never wrote. But in the case of Ramanuja, what happens is, Ramanuja was supposed to have, there is an interesting story here. Yamuna was the one who actually wrote a few things. And of course, his most important one, of course, was his defense of the Agama ritual tradition. So you can see by this time, the Alvar Bhakti tradition is beginning to be systematized into philosophical ideas on the one hand, and then serious ritual tradition is brought in through the Agama text. So ritualization of the tradition and philosophization, systematization. It's analogous to like how you have systematic theology in Christianity long after some 400 or 500 years after Jesus, you know, his disciples have all gone, the New Testament was written and all of that was gone, systematic philosophy or theology of Christianity develops. And same thing is, similar things are happening here. So Yamana writes a few things, setting the tradition in place. And then apparently, Yamana, of course Ramanuja by then was a small kid, new kid in the block. Right, so he was being still trained, and he was tutored by some of these Tamil local teachers. He studies with the Brahmanical teachers, but then he goes to Tamil teachers, the local vernacular teachers. Now here you also see the interesting caste interaction between the Brahmin groups and the non-Brahmin. The Alwars, most of them, or every one of them actually, were non-Brahmins. There are all kinds of interesting stories here. So in this first story, now Yamana is now on the verge of dying. He is like, you know, towards the fag end of his life, and in a few days' time he would, you know, die. So he then wanted to know, he comes to know about Ramanuja as a bright young student coming up. So he was very fascinated by his intellect, and then he sends two of his messengers, disciples, to go fetch Ramanuja because he wanted to see him and speak to him. And then these two disciples go off to Srirangam, and Yamana is in Kanchipuram. So then by the time Ramanuja came, Yamana died. And then Ramanuja comes, and then he was so sad that he missed the opportunity to speak. He also came to know about Yamana as a big teacher in the tradition and so on. So he wanted to meet him as well. So then Ramanuja was so sad, and then he was wondering what to do. And then he noticed Yamana, his body is lying on the floor. And then his three fingers, the last three, were kind of folded like this. And then he asked why Yamana's fingers are like that. And then, Yamana wanted three commentaries to be written, and he wanted to do it in his lifetime, but he couldn't, but he wanted someone to do it. And then he said, okay, what are they? He said, one is the commentary on the Vedanta Sutras, Brahma Sutras. The other is the commentary on the Upanishads, the Chandogya and the other one, Brihadaranyaka. And then the third one is the Gita, the commentary on the Alwar hymns. And then he says, Ramanuja says, yes, I will do it. Then apparently it was noticed that Yamana's three fingers came off. So that was seen as a sign that here is this, you know, the next man in line. So Ramanuja then becomes heir apparent to Yamana, and he was then groomed in the tradition as the upcoming teacher and so on. Then what happens is Ramanuja, for some odd reason, does not write his commentary on the Nalayar Divya Prabandha, the Tamil words. Now, it is debatable whether he tried to avoid his association with Tamil vernacular kind of tradition, because he was addressing a highly intellectual, Brahmanical kind of group in the face of his preceding heavy, influential Shankara kind of Advaita kind of tradition, or whether he had any other, you know, genuine reason, we don't know. So what he does is he asks Pillan, his disciple, to write commentary on the especially the Thiruvai Moili of Namalwa. And then Pillan writes that commentary. Of course, that becomes extremely important source for the subsequent split of this tradition into Southern School and the Northern School. Nothing to do with North India and South India. It's just Northern and Southern in the sense of two different groups. So the Southern School went in the direction of Tamil vernacular tradition. The Northern School went in the direction of Sanskritic and so on. And then you have the two cities, Kanchipuram becoming the seat of Northern School and the Srirangam becoming the seat of Southern School and so on. So the period of Yamuna and Ramanuja is what I considered is the period of systematization when serious philosophy is introduced into the tradition and ideas are systematically articulated. And then the period after that is what I have identified as the period of popularization. Now, during this period, you don't come across serious commentaries being written following the tradition of Ramanuja, who wrote serious commentaries. But here, it's more him writing, but in Sanskrit. So the tradition now moves away from the Tamil to highly Sanskritized form of, bhakti and so on. So there are important hymn writers like Srivatsanka Mishra and Parasar Bhattar. Parasar Bhattar was the one who succeeded Ramanuja in the Srirangam temple. You see, the interesting thing is all of these are not only serious philosophers, they were also priests in the temples. So they wrote commentaries and wrote philosophical texts, but at the same time observing serious rituals throughout the day and doing the priestly duties and so on. And that period is followed by what I call the period of schism, division. Now here, of course, the seeds of that schism could be seen earlier on, but by the 13th century, if we date Ramanuja around the 11th century, so you have this period between 11th and 12th, by the 13th century, by the time we arrive 13th century, this is now the almost the thick of the Mughal era in the Indian history, in the north. South, of course, is beginning to be affected, but still kind of not yet. It's still ruled by Hindu kings in the south. So here, during this period, serious theological debates develop that eventually drive the tradition into two different directions. As I said, the Southern School and the Northern School formally start to kind of debate these serious differences. There are 18 different differences that are identified, as to the points of differences. One of which is the loyalty to the Tamil tradition, and the other one, which I did my research on, was the place of the goddess in the tradition. And that's the topic of my doctoral research. And that's the, it's a serious kind of matter for them. Although from the title of my book, it looks like I wrote something on Goddess Lakshmi, but when you read that, there's nothing to do with Lakshmi actually in the way we kind of read. Like in South Africa or in India, when I go around, people, when they see my book, they think they can use that book to go and, use it in the temple to say something about Lakshmi. I tell them, please, it's absolutely no help to you because it has nothing to do with that. It's a serious debate about the status, the theological, doctrinal distinctions they articulated during that period, and the place of the goddess in relation to Vishnu, in terms of the idea of liberation, you know, the means to salvation and so on, whether the goddess is the means to Vishnu and then Vishnu is the means to ultimate liberation, or whether one could directly go to Vishnu or go to Vishnu, you know, Lakshmi first, you know, all these are seriously debated. And there were two individuals that actually are key to this period. Pillai Lokacharya, who identified himself more to the Tamil vernacular tradition, who drew more from the Namalvar's Thiruvai Moili and the commentary of Pillan. And then there were subsequent commentaries on those commentaries and so on by a number of people. And Venkatanatha, also known as Vedanta Desika, who wrote extensively in serious philosophical stuff. He didn't actually want to use Tamil sources, but he used mostly Sanskritic sources for his texts. And he was more of a philosopher rather than a theologian kind of person. So that's more or less the development of that whole tradition. And of course, by this 13th century division was eventually formalized in the 18th century, when the issue by the British period became centered around the control of temples rather than just these theological differences. So it becomes much more political issue. So once the temples take on different positions, then who controls those temples becomes important. And also this has all kinds of ritual implications. In other words, in the ritual procession of Sri Rangam temple, there was always a precedence for the Tamil singers to go before the procession. In other words, when you have the Utsava Murthy, the image of the god taken in procession around the temple, the priests go in a procession, and then there is a particular order in which they have to follow in and sing these various hymns and chant various Sanskrit mantras and so on. So whether the procession should be headed by Tamil singers or Sanskrit singers. So that's a kind of a deep theological, ritual point. Now, that impinges naturally on who controls the temple. So if the northerners are controlling the temple, then they would put the Sanskrit pandits first ahead of the procession, and then the Tamil ones come. If the southerners are controlling the temple, then it's the other way around. So eventually the 18th century, which culminated in the formal division, well, there were a number of court cases actually about this whole issue, you know, of the procession of temples and so on. And then the court cases couldn't be decided because then it was not only bordering on the customary laws, but also Anglo-Saxon British laws that were already in place by the colonial period of that time. So the British were using two different sets of laws in administering India at that period. For all practical local purposes, they used local laws, customary laws and so on, drawing from whatever caste rules and so on. And for serious kind of property cases, etc., they had to rely on the, you know, the standard British, Anglo-Saxon, Dutch, Roman kind of laws. So the matter eventually had to be referred to the House of Commons in London. And in House of Commons, a decision was taken to divide the tradition into two. So it was a political decision, not just a theological decision. So there goes religion. Let's now see some of that theology. The theology of Olivers is sometimes described by scholars as territorial theology. Let me just read something from Vasudha Narayana, page 33. You should, you know, for fun at least, just read some of these things. These are in the library. At the moment they are with me. I'll put them back by tomorrow. Now here, one of the Alvars, known as Kulashekara Alvar, he writes in the following way: in the beautiful city of Ayodhya, encircled by towers, a flame that lit up all the walls appeared in the solar rays and gave life to all heavens. This warrior with the dazzling eyes, Rama, dark as a cloud, the first one, my only lord, is in Chitrakuta, city of Tila. When is the day when my eyes will behold him and rejoice? So in other words, the god of Ayodhya, of this classical kind of place, is visualized in the local place called Chitrakuta. Now that's more important for them. So the god of this local place makes more sense for them, and their theology therefore is woven around those local ideas, local myths, local legends, and so on. Let's read a few later on. And most of the hymns revolve around the various temples in the south and the incarnations of Vishnu in those temples. Now here, Vishnu is in the songs not worshipped just as Vishnu, but as local names, Ranganatha, Varadaraja, of the local temple deities. According to the tradition of the Alvars, the Sri Vaishnava, South Indian Tamil tradition, there are about 108 sacred places that are sacred to Vaishnavas in India. And the Alvars, for them, most important of the 108. 108 is a kind of a very common auspicious number that you would come across in most 108 Upanishads, 108 Puranas, and Agama texts. 108 is some kind of sacred number. So there again, it shows by associating their writings and their sacred places with that kind of numbers, they're also trying to link with this larger tradition, the pan-Indian kind of tradition. So the most important places are Srirangam and Kanchipuram. Of course, Srirangam is probably above all of them, is probably even today most well known, because Kanchipuram also is a place for Shaivites. So Vaishnavites actually somehow don't, their first mention would be Srirangam in the south. Kanchipuram will be second. Now, page 35. Let me just read from the devotee's point of view. The most important location of Vishnu's dwelling place, of course, is the heart, heart of the devotee. Now here is one example. The poet goes on to say, in deceit he procured 3 paces of land Now, interesting here. Now, this is actually calling attention to the Sanskrit myth, the Puranic story, where Vishnu requests three paces from this demon king, Mahabali. And unwittingly, he grants him. Then, you know the story. So Vishnu then, the idea is to crush this demon to the netherworld and to finish him off. So eventually the third feet has to be on his foot, on his head. So the poet here is playing on this kind of theme. You know, there's a pun here, in deceit. God was deceitful here. Vishnu really cheated this guy, the demon. There's no doubt about that. So the poet is saying here, in deceit he procured three paces of land from Mahabali and then measured them. It is he who reclines in the flood, they say. It is who resides in Venkatam, that is the Tirupati, the modern Tirupati in Andhra Pradesh, traditionally known as Venkatachalam, and for short they call it Venkatam. Oh, look, my friend, he reclines in the flood, he resides in Venkatam. Now you see how the local name is repeated. It's not just this Vishnu of this old mythological story, but it is the one who lives in Venkatam. That's the, behold, he is within the heart of Kalikandri. Kalikandri is the Thirumangai Alvar, one of the Alvars, who always thought of himself as this gopi, the female devotee. So the final seat of God is the heart of the devotee. So that's the and then chanting the divine names is another important theme in the Alvar poetry. Page 48. The flowers of the sea-colored Lord swell over this earth, singing with melody, dancing and wailing with joy. We see them. The wailing age of Kali ends. The divine ones also enter. The golden age dawns, and floods of great joy sweep over the land. The flowers of him who is dark as a cloud, my Lord, the one colored like the sea, fill this earth singing with melody there all over the land. So this kind of ecstasy, expression of ecstasy.
Sorry,
yes.
Please.
Yeah, please. Is an important element in the Alvar poetry. There is an important shift that takes place in the treatment of Sanskrit gods in the Tamil/South Indian devotional culture. Now, Ramanujan, the guy who wrote this one, says, even though the Tamil devotional poetry emerges within the context of the already patronized Sanskritic culture, he says, for the first time in India, Hindu philosophy and theology speak in a language other than Sanskrit. Now, I've written an essay, partly this is one of the points that I made in my Spalding lecture the other day. One of the restlessnesses, if I may have used a stupid word, for the study of Hinduism point of view is by enormously focusing on the Sanskritic literature, scholars seem to have missed the enormous variegatedness, the diversity that existed in the vernacular writings. Because it is generally assumed that when you study Hinduism, you study Sanskrit. That's where you begin, assuming that everything is Sanskrit and so on. And then even when you treat later on the various themes, it's the Vedanta Sanskritic notions that flow into how we have constructed Hinduism. But if only we paid attention to, Sheldon Pollack from Chicago, he makes this point rather in a serious, he's very passionate about this. According to his argument, the shift had already taken place very early on from Sanskrit to vernacular. The intellectual discourse in India had shifted from vernacular to the, from Sanskrit to the vernacular. And for a while, even during that transition, the intellectuals made use of both Sanskrit and vernacular. And therefore, they had to be Ubhayabhasha Pandita. They had to be experts in both languages in order to be respected by scholars. So they had to know like Latin. You know, if you are a serious Western philosophy scholar, you have to know some of the Latin, all that, serious, European kind of language stuff, Greek and so on. Other than English, German, whatever language you use to write your contemporary philosophy. So he makes this point, actually. For the first time now, this is a period like anywhere from 7th to the 9th century already. There's a shift. And Sanskrit gods are fashioned in uniquely South Indian style as kings in palaces. Now this is an interesting idea. If you read in Sanskrit texts, you don't get this idea. Sanskritic depictions of God are very different, along the lines of Vedic kind of Rigveda, textual type of, descriptions. And nowhere in this Tamil tradition, the use of the word, whenever they refer to gods, they never use the word God, Deva, etc. Although the corrupt, modified form of Deva in Tamil does occur quite commonly in popular usage. But when they refer to their gods, they always used a term that actually is the same term that would have been used for kings. Nada, Raja, Ranganada, Vardaraja. Raja means king. Nada is the Lord. And their description of that god in the temple is analogous to this king sitting in the royal court. And many of the rituals actually are patterned, modeled along the lines of these kings, walking around with the entourage of all these, gods and so on, and the procession, the temple procession of the Utsavamurti, the image of the temple inside, is pretty similar to how a king is, walking around. If you go to Mysore and observe this festival of Dasara, I don't know if you know Dasara,
mm-hmm.
The American-born ones, do you guys know? No? Okay. Dasara is a very popular one in the south. Some of the North Indian cities, it's also quite popular. It occurs in October. That's also the time when schools are closed for holidays. So we always had Dasara holidays. When I was a kid, in school, we always had Dasara holidays. In Mysore, this particular festival has very interesting twist. The king of even to this day, the Maharaja of Mysore, the old Mysore's kingdom, still takes a procession and comes out with his elephants and all these chariots and so on and goes through the city. And and then the, you know, religious processions accompany him. So the idea of God King, you know, fashioned in the same way, is very unique to this theology here. In fact, this is a point that George Hart makes, quoted by Ramanujan. Possession, the idea of possession and bhakti are integral to bhakti poetry. It might also be common in other languages, as we will see later on. Here, the particular mood expressed by the bhakti poets is frenzy. You know, as if you are intoxicated by, you know, something. And in the, what's interesting is, this is very similar to the experience that you would see in the case of village goddesses in rural India, where the frenzy is also linked to the consuming of liquor. I mean, these people who participate in this goddess festival also consume liquor. It's part of the ritual. It's religiously, I mean, it goes back to many of these traditional tribal societies in Africa, Native America, and Aborigines in Australia and so on, where they have this ritually drinking of that liquor, you know. And then that frenzy is actually, liquor actually helps that kind of ecstasy, really. Liquor is part of that ecstatic kind of mood creation, you know. You kind of heighten the mood by taking that liquor. So I used to watch these, they used to call jatras in the, I don't know if you have seen any of these in North India. When I was a kid, I used to be fascinated by these. It's gross when you see it, it's frightening. And as children, we were prevented from watching them because it's very, very kind of, you know, cutting chicken and you know, all this kind of stuff, and people drinking, and everything that is Brahmanical is reversed here. So it's a very interesting kind of thing. Then further on, bhakti poets of the south talked about God not only as possessing but also as incarnating. I mean, the point that I made earlier on. Now Ramanujan notes that this one, that the bhakti theology of the south moved away from the Upanishadic abstract notions of Brahman by focusing on the gods of the mythologies, and also the local. They did focus on the local and the translocal, meaning the transcritic ideas and so on. Ramanujan, however, says that even though bhakti tradition did not entirely discard Upanishadic concepts of non-local, non-concrete Godhead, the Alvas God is never an attributeless Nirguna Brahman, never without body, parts, or passion, or without a local habitation and a name. This is, I think, is one important distinction that you would see as we talk about later on the North Indian, some of the, you know, Kabir type of poets. where nirguna ideas, abstract ideas of the divine are made use of. But the South Indian, the Nyanmars also, this is true of Nyanmar theology, where the theology is highly personified divine rather than this abstract idea of Nirguna Brahman and so on. What are we doing next time? Yes, we go to, we are coming to Tamil Nyanmars in the fourth week. So the next one we look at Kabir, Mirabai and Tulsidas. So we'll get a taste of the North Indian. And then we come south and then we go Kashmir. And then we wander around the villages of the goddess towards the end. And we see some Bengal. Mm.
And, so we get a glimpse of all of India, in a way. Apart from its theological ideas, historically, for studying Hinduism, I think it's extremely important to pay perhaps more attention to these vernacular traditions, and bhakti traditions provide that opportunity, really, to look at, you know, these vernacular, because much of the bhakti tradition is expressed in local vernacular. I mean, they did write serious commentaries in the Sanskrit language, but that's only a tip of the iceberg. The real stuff, actually, the emotive stuff, the powerful, I mean, if you go to a Hindu temple today, what you see there is what you get in these vernacular traditions. So how we construct Hinduism really is how we choose our materials. You know, you can skew it in one direction and say this is, you know, Hinduism, and then skew it in another direction and then say that is Hinduism. You know, somehow one needs to balance it, to look at historically all of these things. And the sad part of it is the extent to which the vernaculars have been neglected in the construction and development of our understanding of Hinduism. So hopefully by doing this course, you would get the dimension that is neglected, ignored, insulted.
Well, maybe the problem is also,
you can switch off this one.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of non-canonical language.
That was ex cathedra now.